Did we cut corners and take chances and risks? There were no corners cut. These vaccines went through all of the standard testing processes, trialing processes. The clinical trials ran to scale, went through all of the different gates that vaccines need to go through to get approved, and medicine needs to go through to get approved.
COVID-19 has upset the balance of the world, and while some countries are starting to settle into a new normal, South Africa is unfortunately not there yet. You're listening to this Everything You Need to Know About COVID-19 and Vaccines podcast series brought to you by Discovery Health. This series is aimed at helping you understand the facts around COVID-19 and vaccines in South Africa. Today, we're talking about the importance of vaccines in the fight against COVID-19 with Discovery Health's Chief Commercial Officer, Dr. Ronald Whelan. I am your host, Mudiwa Gavaza, a writer with The Business Day and Financial Mail, and this conversation is one that's not to be missed. Dr. Whelan, how are you today?
Good day to you, Mudiwa, and good day to your listeners. Great to be with you. Thank you for hosting us.
You know, when we look at comparing the first, the second, and the third wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, I think a good place for us to start is getting a sense around what the data from Discovery Health actually tells us about some of the key issues that people have been grappling with. What has been, you know, the rate of infection between the different waves, and what have you seen in terms of hospital admissions as well as the mortality rates between the different waves of COVID-19?
Yeah, it's been interesting, Madiwa. There have been three very different waves in one pandemic. And I think it's firstly important to point out that each of the waves has been caused by a different variant of the virus. So the wave one was caused by the original variant out of Wuhan. Remember that the virus originated out of Wuhan, Hubei province in China. The second wave was then caused by the Beta variant, the so-called B1351 variant that at the time was called the South Africa variant. And then the third wave has obviously been caused by the Delta variant. And each of these variants is manifested in slightly different ways. You know, some have been more infectious, others have been less infectious, some have had greater morbidity risk, and others have lesser morbidity risk. In addition, the waves have manifested quite differently across South Africa. So you remember that the first wave started out with our first case in KZN, then spread predominantly down to the Western Cape. The second wave started in the Eastern Cape, moved down the Garden Route, then into the Western Cape, and had a very severe impact on KZN. And then the third wave has obviously impacted Gauteng in the most pronounced way. From an infection point of view, Discovery's been tracking the infections very closely, as you would well imagine. We had over 350,000 Discovery members infected with COVID to date. Of those, we had 80,000 recorded infections in the first wave, 100,000 infections recorded in the second wave. And the third wave has been really severe from a Discovery perspective, so 150,000 infections recorded in the third wave. And there's a simple reason for that, in that we have a high proportion of Discovery members in the Gauteng province. And as I mentioned, the third wave has impacted Gauteng. So it's understandable that we had very high infection rates in the third wave across Discovery. When you compare that with the national waves, and what we look at on the national waves are, we think the most reliable indicator is excess deaths. Excess deaths is the number of deaths in excess of the long-term average deaths. We find that the first wave had about the lowest number of excess deaths. The second wave had the highest number of excess deaths. And the third wave had less excess deaths. So slightly different picture to what we're seeing from a Discovery perspective. So from a South Africa perspective, the second wave was the most severe. From a Discovery perspective, we certainly saw the most infections in the third wave. What is interesting is if you then begin to scratch below the surface around how severe were the infections across these waves. And what we see there is admission rates were the highest in the second wave. And that stands to reason. We know that the Beta variant was a very severe variant and had high morbidity and high mortality rates. So we saw very high admission rates in the second wave. About 20% of people across the Discovery base who contracted COVID were admitted to hospital. Fortunately, now in the third wave, the admission rates have dropped off to about 18%. So we're seeing lower admission rates in the third wave, which I think is quite reassuring. We're also seeing slightly lower case fatality rates across our discovery data in the third wave. So the Delta variant, while being more transmissible, seems to be less severe from a morbidity and a mortality perspective.
You know, with everything that you're saying, just running us through the first, the second, and the third wave, one of the biggest fears that people have had is this issue of reinfection. I think in the first wave, people sort of thought that it's like chickenpox. Once you have it, you never have it again, or you build up that immunity. But on the ground, what is your data telling you guys about the rates of reinfection between the different waves?
Yeah, such a good question and a very interesting question when you unpack the detail on this. We've done extensive analysis on reinfection through all three waves. I think the first thing worth mentioning, Madiwa, is that we've recorded 3,300 people who've been had two or more positive COVID tests. So that implies that they would likely have had two infections. And we only record those so long as there's been a 90-day interval between the two tests. So we're reasonably confident. So about 1% of people who've had a COVID infection had an additional positive infection. So that kind of gives you some indicator on the reinfections we're seeing. That's not the full picture, however. What we see across the different waves is high reinfection rates coming out of wave one. And the reason for that is that the original virus out of Wuhan didn't create massive antibody levels and didn't give you the protection against, you know, the subsequent variants that, you know, came into play. So we saw very high reinfection rates here coming out of wave one. We saw lower reinfection rates coming out of wave two. And the reason for that is the Beta variant, as I mentioned earlier on, is a very severe variant that created lots of antibodies that, you know, where there was knock-on protection, you know, past that. So I think, yeah, the good news is that we're seeing less reinfections coming out if you've been infected with the Beta variant. We'll see how the Delta variant now plays out. The bad news, as you rightly mentioned, is that we do see reinfections. It's about a 20% relative risk of reinfection if you've had COVID before. So when you compare yourself against the general population, you've got about a 1 in 5 chance of being infected again. So that's what we're seeing from a reinfection perspective. It's related, as I said, to the variants. It's also related to how antibodies wane over time.
And then related to that issue of antibodies and, you know, trying to reduce the general rate of infection and hopefully reinfection over time, people are anticipating that, you know, we might see even a fourth wave coming up in the next couple of months. But what would seem as if it would be different about this one compared to the other two will be the fact that so many countries, including South Africa, would have been well underway with their vaccinations, immunizations, that type of thing. How are you guys sort of anticipating or, you know, feeding that into your models? You know, how many lives are likely to be saved because people are now getting vaccinated?
Yeah, you make exactly the right point. The difference between a prospective fourth wave and the first, second, and third wave is we've got vaccines at play. This is the first wave where vaccines should make a meaningful difference. Of course, we had vaccines at play for the over 60s in the third wave already, and we can speak about some of the insights here we're seeing there. But vaccines are really our big chance to avert a significant and substantial fourth wave. And our actuaries have done some modeling on this already. I know it's a tough pill to swallow because we're barely out of the third wave and are starting to think about the fourth wave. Our projections for the fourth wave is that it's likely to start to gain some speed and momentum in the early parts of December of 2021. It'll then peak somewhere towards the middle of February, end of February 2022. The big question around the fourth wave is what's the severity of the fourth wave going to look like? And that really depends on a few factors. The first factor it depends on is vaccines, if South Africa has got high vaccine uptake or not. The second factor it depends on is, are there any additional variants that come into play? We've seen numerous variants already. There are already over 400 variants identified globally. There are likely to be additional variants who are coming into play going forward. And then the third factor at play is how we behave. We've learned that from wave 1, 2, and 3 is our social behaviors drive a lot of these wave trends and patterns. So social gatherings, super spreader events, festivals, and so on and so forth. So it's really those three factors that will impact our fourth wave. What we've tried to do is get a sense on what would be the potential impact if we're able to vaccinate at scale. And we're confident we can vaccinate at scale because we have so many vaccines available in South Africa now. At a high level, if we're able to vaccinate 65% of adults in South Africa before December, and remember the wave starts in early December, so we need to move quickly, there's an opportunity for South Africa to save 67,000 lives. And I think that is a massive opportunity for us. I think in addition to that, obviously the most important thing is saving lives, we also stand the chance of flattening the curve and limiting the restrictions for December. And I know most of you are on this webinar, and I certainly missed my summer holiday last year. And I think we'd all love to have a summer holiday this year. So if that's not an added incentive to get vaccinated and help us suppress the fourth wave, then I don't know what is.
I completely agree with you there. On the one hand, you are saving lives. I think the 67,000, number that you gave is quite big, but at the same time, also saving us from not being indoors as much and, maybe having a decent festive season, or at least opening up a little bit more. Anything on that front would be good. But at the same time, as much as we do talk about how good vaccines are, there is still a lot of hesitation out there. Maybe you can talk to us, because in the past, vaccines have largely nullified the impact of, other pandemics such as smallpox, measles, I think mumps, polio out there. At the same time, people almost on an annual basis have been getting things like the flu vaccines and stuff like that. So maybe you can talk to us about how effective some of those previous efforts have been as, we try to engender a little bit more confidence in people right now.
Yeah, firstly, I think as you rightly mentioned, vaccines have been very effective in nullifying and in many respects eradicating very severe diseases. And I think the most prominent example is smallpox. Smallpox was one of the first major diseases completely eradicated as a result of a vaccination, a very, very severe disease that has now disappeared from the world. We've made significant grounds on polio as well, as you well know. I think there's only three or four countries globally and a handful of cases globally on polio as a result of extensive polio vaccination efforts. But I think the most powerful example I've certainly come across is data out of the US. The US, for the better part of the 20th century, used to record about 500,000 measles infections every year. Through vaccination and the development of the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, they're recording less than 100 cases of measles every year in the US. And where they are recording measles cases now are in communities that are unvaccinated communities. So I think it really speaks to the power of vaccines in being able to reduce a disease and in fact, eradicate disease. And then, of course, we have the annual flu vaccine. So the flu vaccine is a well-tried and tested vaccine. The flu vaccine, I think, important for your listeners is we update the flu vaccine on an annual basis, because the flu vaccine, every year we have a slightly different strain of flu, and we need to predict what that particular year's strain of flu is going to be. So that's the reason we have your annual flu vaccines. The efficacy of the flu vaccine varies from year to year. So some years we get it right and some years we don't get it so right. On average, we see flu vaccine efficacy of somewhere between 50 and 70%, sometimes goes as high as 80%. But I think what we do know about the flu vaccine is it's very effective in reducing severe disease and morbidity and mortality in older populations and people with underlying chronic diseases. And in many respects, that's quite similar to the COVID vaccine. So the COVID-19 vaccine is very effective at reducing severe disease, hospitalization, and death. Yeah, so quite similar in outcomes to the flu vaccine. What is important is when you compare the efficacy of the COVID-19 vaccines to the flu vaccine, I think you'll agree that they are significantly higher than the flu vaccine. So we're seeing efficacy rates of well above 80% compared to the average flu vaccine that hovers around the 50 to 70% mark.
I think the word efficacy used to be one of those random words in the dictionary that people sort of memorized for spelling bees, but has now become part of our common lexicon because of all the vaccine talk. And with that in mind, that's one of the big questions that people have, because in South Africa, we've got the Johnson & Johnson and the Pfizer vaccine. And we find ourselves having this discussion a day or two after the Pfizer vaccine has received full FDA approval. So maybe you can just talk to us about the difference between the two, because I think that's one of the things that people do wonder about. Which one is more effective? Which one should I get?
Yeah, it's a tricky question to answer. And I think the high level answer on that is that both of these vaccines are excellent vaccines. So both have been proven to be very efficacious and very safe, both globally and in South Africa. Yeah, I wanted to speak a little bit about the efficacy of these vaccines in the South African landscape. So Discovery has done extensive analytics alongside colleagues at the Medical Research Council, Professor Glenn de Grand team, and the Sasonke team on vaccine efficacy across the J&J vaccine. Discovery's also done some internal research on the efficacy of the Pfizer vaccine. And what we're seeing on this, and these are, we think of efficacy across three lenses. The first is, how efficacious is the vaccine at reducing transmission of infection? Secondly, how efficacious is it reducing in hospital admissions and severe disease? And thirdly, and most importantly, how efficacious is it reducing death? And what we're seeing as a commonality across both J&J and Pfizer in a South African context is somewhere 2 to 4 times reduction in infection risk on the back of vaccination, a 3 to 6 times reduction in hospitalization risk, and then most importantly, a 20 times reduction, 10 to 20 times reduction in death risk. I mean, these are just startling statistics here when you compare vaccinated populations versus unvaccinated populations. And I think on the Pfizer vaccine, what we see is a very good efficacy after the first dose, most particularly 2 weeks after the first dose. But what really ramps up is once you've had your second dose of Pfizer, then the protection ramps up to 80% levels, which is really, really good. And I think it gives us a lot of confidence around these vaccines in the South Africa context. When we look at the results globally, we're finding even more confidence around infection reduction risks, severe disease risks, and death risks. So up to 10 to 15 times reduction in many of those metrics in case studies globally, whether they're out of Australia, San Diego, and so on and so forth. So lots of your confidence around the vaccines from a South Africa perspective.
And maybe we can continue looking at the world, zooming out to look at what's going on in the world, because the vaccine rollouts are a big thing at the moment. What do you make of what's been going on around the world in terms of vaccination efforts? And are there any interesting or emerging trends that you guys, have noted in addition to some of the ones that you just mentioned with the likes of San Diego, etc.?
Well, it's certainly a global vaccination race, and I think it's fascinating watching the different countries go up against each other. We had Israel winning the early parts of the race, and then we had the UK coming into the mix, and recently Canada's really started to ramp up their vaccination program. So I think you could think of this as a commenting on a race day of sorts. I think it's been fascinating to watch that play out. I think the most startling statistic for me, Madiwa, is we're now over 4.6 billion doses of vaccines administered into people's arms globally. I mean, just think about that number, 4.6 billion doses of vaccine delivered globally across many countries across the globe. I mean, it's just an enormous quantity. And I think it's miraculously that we've developed, we've been able to manufacture these vaccines in that space of time. That we've got them into people's arms in that space of time. So just a brilliant, brilliant effort. Obviously, are watching the trends on many of the leading countries closely. So Israel, we watch here very closely because they were first out of the box and got a big portion of their population vaccinated. What they've been tracking very closely is their breakthrough infections, their hospitalizations, and they've seen very, very good results. What they are starting to see now is some level of drop-off in immunity levels, and are starting to think through booster doses. So we're watching those trends and patterns closely. At the same time, I think we acknowledge that there are many countries across the globe that still haven't had their first doses of vaccine. So we need to watch for vaccine equality closely. And certainly from a South Africa perspective, We would love to be vaccinating from early in 2021 because of the global demand for vaccines. We were delayed until May. So I think equality is something that we've certainly got to watch closely globally. But it's been a fascinating landscape. I think the one thing that does give us reassurance in addition to the volumes of vaccines developed is that the vaccines remain stable against the new variants, and most particularly the Delta variant. So there's been a slight drop off in efficacy, but it certainly gives us confidence that these vaccines still may remain effective against the variants. What I'm very, very excited by is I don't think it'll be too long before we'll see vaccination for kids in South Africa as well, particularly kids between the ages of 12 and 18. We know that the vaccines are approved for use in children in most European countries and indeed in the US. And I think that's a trend we're watching closely, and we're certainly continuing to work alongside the National Department of Health and other colleagues around opening up access as soon as we've been able to vaccinate our adult population.
Mm. And it's actually quite fascinating and very encouraging the type of progress that the world has been able to make. That 4.6 billion number that you're talking about in less than a year is quite massive in terms of just showing what can be done when, the world decides that they're actually going to just all be behind this one particular program. If we do zoom in on the South Africa situation, vaccinations have been ramping up of late. And if social media is to be believed, then the young people, because now we've reached a stage where it's up to the ages of 18 and above that are getting vaccinated, and a lot of efforts are being made. Young people are now getting involved, and I know that of late there were a lot of social media posts from even Discovery sites. So maybe you can give us some insight into what you're seeing in South Africa, what have been some of the trends from the various sites, your own sites, and where do we see things progressing?
Yeah, I must say it's been quite a fun and exciting ride watching the vaccination program in South Africa. I think the first thing worth mentioning is we're now well over 10.5 million vaccinations delivered in South Africa, which is remarkable. So we're pushing over 20% of the target population vaccinated. It's been terrific to see people across the country of all ages and races and provinces roll up their sleeves to get vaccinated. And I think it's in many respects, it's felt a little bit like a World Cup experience again, in that that level of excitement and exuberance. And we certainly feel that excitement and exuberance every time a new age category opens up. I remember the day, our first day of vaccination on the 17th of May, and we opened up to over 60s. We were flooded with people over the age of 60, and pushed up the average age of our One Discovery place head office dramatically during that day. And it was just fabulous to see our older generation come in for vaccination en masse. And I think what was the most heartwarming part of that exercise is the relief on people's faces after being vaccinated. You could see that we'd been pent up and under lockdown for so long, felt cooped up, and was anxious and scared about the potential impact of COVID, and having a vaccine in your arm just kind of became a big stress reliever. We've seen similar excitement, Madiwa, in the 18s to 35s, and a different level of excitement. And it's been very fun and exciting to see, in that this is our social media crowd. And we've been exposed to Instagram and TikTok and Snapchat. And it's been incredibly, incredibly exciting. We doubled our daily vaccination volumes when we opened up to the 18s to 35s. We hit new daily records. We vaccinated as Discovery on the first day of the 18 to 35, 17,000 people. I mean, 17,000 people rolled up their sleeves across Discovery vaccination sites on the day of opening for the 18s to 35s. Huge excitement, huge buzz, lots of challenges and around getting friends and family vaccinated. So I really loved the energy of the 18s to 35. Different energy for the plus 60s was a real sense of relief. 18s to 35 really revved it up a gear for us. From a South Africa perspective, we are very encouraged by the progress across the country. So we're seeing good rollout across all of the provinces, and we're seeing a good uptake. We do have a bit of a challenge to get men to vaccination sites. So we're finding in the public sector that women are leading the charge on vaccination. I think it's a testimony to their knowledgeability and their discipline. And we kind of need to spur our male colleagues along for vaccination. It's important that we get them done as well. What's really important about South Africa's program is it's now moving at pace. We've got more than sufficient vaccine for everyone across South Africa. We've got many, many sites available across South Africa, both in the public sector and the private sector. So it's easy to access vaccination. And then most importantly, vaccination is entirely free of charge. No one across South Africa pays for a vaccine. If you're a member of a medical aid, it's funded by your medical aid. It doesn't come out of your medical savings account. So it doesn't impact your pocket at all. And if you're don't have a medical aid, it's funded by the state. And you can drop in at any private site or any public site across South Africa for a vaccination and get a vaccine free of charge. And I think that's real credit to the joint efforts of both the public sector and the private sector in South Africa in enabling access to vaccination.
You know, as someone who falls squarely in that 18 to 35 block, I can definitely say that we are excited because we just want to go out. I think that's where the stakes are for us. We're tired of being indoors. And I think that's testament to the promise that we are seeing when it comes to the vaccines. But at the same time, like you said, you know, trying to get more men out, you know, trying to get all of these things, it speaks to a bigger issue, and that's vaccine hesitancy. Because as great as things are, as enthusiastic as the social media generation is about going to go out and get vaccinated, there's still a significant portion of people that are hesitant about getting vaccinated. So maybe you could give us some insight, because, you know, just talking to you, everything makes sense. It makes logical sense that getting vaccinated is the way forward, especially for reducing serious illness and then reducing deaths, just reflecting on some of the numbers that you gave earlier on. So what's actually driving hesitancy at the moment? And do you think the reasons locally, are they the same as, you know, what we see in the rest of the world? Or are there any SA-specific trends? I remember I was seeing something where someone said that the vaccine will wipe out your DNA. And I was like, okay. So maybe you can, talk to us about that.
I think the first thing to say, Madiwa, is that as with any medical treatment and any procedure, you should always weigh up the benefits and the risks. It's no different for vaccines, and you need to make sure that you're fully informed around the benefits as well as the risks. If you're taking antibiotics, you would do the same thing. If you're taking painkillers, you would do the same thing. And in many respects, when one thinks about the food we consume, we should probably be doing the same. I mean, how often do we put food and drink into our bodies without ever thinking about what's actually the ingredient here? I think it is important that people think about this carefully, weigh up the information available, look for reliable and credible sources of information on this. The common themes we're seeing around vaccine hesitancy is, I think the most common one is people are worried about side effects. And there are some side effects with vaccines. There's side effects with most medications. Fortunately, and Discovery Health has done extensive analysis on the side effects. So what we're finding is about 1 in 20 people experience side effects. I mean, just log that as a point, 5%. 1 in 20 people have some side effects. Of those 1 in 20 people, well over 90%, well over 95%, in fact, have very mild side effects. And the mild side effects are the typical flu-like type side effects. A slight pain at the injection site, slight inflammation, could be a slight fever, but nothing more severe than that. And what we've actually done at Discovery is we monitor medicine usage patterns 5 days after vaccination. And I can tell you those medicine usage patterns are just standard over-the-counter medication, standard paracetamol, ibuprofen. People resolve from those side effects with no problem at all. The rarer side effects are very few and far between. And so there was a lot of concern raised, and I think perhaps quite a lot of buzz around clotting as the major question that comes up quite often. And I can tell you out of the trials, the major clotting side effects are extremely rare. Less than 1 in 100,000 people will have some degree of clotting. In fact, what I'm more concerned about is that COVID itself, if you get a COVID infection, that causes clotting. In fact, most of the severe sequelae related to COVID are related to clotting. So side effects is, you know, I guess, the big category. The second big category is a concern around the speed of the development of the vaccine and saying, did we cut corners and take chances and risks? There were no corners cut. These vaccines went through all of the standard testing processes, trialing processes. The clinical trials ran to scale, went through all of the different gates that vaccines need to go through to get approved, and medicine needs to go through to get approved. It's just that we're in a global pandemic with all hands on deck. And because all hands on deck, and given the extensive financial and operational investment, we're able to move through the process a lot quicker than we would ordinarily. And I think it just shows you how quickly you could actually move through these processes. I'm actually hoping that our COVID learning accelerates approval of future vaccines and indeed your future drugs. These vaccines have also been developed by leading companies and leading scientists globally. So I think we're entirely comfortable with that. And then we've got a third category of concerns that are a little bit more obscure. You mentioned the DNA concern. I can guarantee you, Madhua, the vaccines do not impact your DNA in any way whatsoever. In fact, vaccines are a very natural process. It's your body's own response to the vaccine that, you know, gives you protection. So your body creates its own antibodies against this the vaccine, and that's what gives you lifetime protection. It doesn't impact your DNA. Also doesn't result in infertility. And from a male perspective, no impotence side effects, no erectile dysfunction side effects. I've heard that pop up a few times during the last few weeks or so. So I think it's a question of continuing to ask the question, but at the same time seeking reliable answers and information. And I'm hoping as Discovery, we're certainly making reliable information available through these sorts of talks with you, Madhua, and then also on our website, we've got a full set of up-to-date, reliable information developed by our clinical excellence team that will give you all of the facts and figures around vaccines.
I like the fact that you've broken down the hesitancy in all of those different, you know, buckets of people that have their different reasons. And especially towards the end where you talk about infertility, that really seems to be a big issue for people. But very quickly, as a follow-up, another one is some people might say, you know, if I have no core morbidities, or, you know, if I am, you know, not in an at-risk group, do I even need to get vaccinated? Because there are those that are just hoping that herd immunity will just benefit us all.
Yeah, I mean, I think we get this question a lot from the younger population. And the reality is that, you know, COVID transmission risks are the same across all segments of the population. It's the outcomes that differ. So the younger population, particularly kids, have asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic infections. But I can tell you from the Discovery data, and particularly over the last three months or so, we are seeing increasing hospital admissions for younger populations. And so what we're seeing at the moment, and I've been quite startled by these statistics, is out of every 100 admissions we have, 25 are in the 18 to 35 category. 33% are in the 35 to 49 category. So almost 60% of Discovery's admissions are between the ages of 18 and 50. And I think that is a stark reminder for us. If we walk through the hospital corridors, 60% of COVID admissions would be in that age group. That doesn't mean that your risk of getting admitted to hospital is in that category. It just means that there are people in hospital in that category. In fact, what we find is about a 5% admission risk for 18s to 34s and about a 15% admission risk for 35s to 49s. But that's a risk. And I think on the back of that risk, it's important for the younger populations to get vaccinated and recognize that while the impact may be more severe on older populations, certainly younger populations continue to get COVID.
I like the fact that you do concretize that, because I think the common thinking has been that, you know, as a young person, you'll be fine and you won't really be at risk. But making it known that 25%, you know, of people that are getting admitted, etc., are coming from that age group, you know, should be a reminder that even young people can either get the disease or pass it on to other people, but more importantly, that it can have severe consequences on them. So as we end off this discussion, Ron, when it comes to the people that do want to, you know, they've listened to this and they are now convinced, they're saying, okay, I now want to go get my jab. From a discovery point of view, how can people actually register? I think you mentioned earlier on insured, uninsured, you know, maybe you can just reiterate that point.
Firstly, there are many vaccination sites across the country, public and private sites that are available to everyone. So anyone can go into any vaccination site across the country, get the vaccine free of charge. That's, I think, the most important message around this. From a discovery perspective, we run 9 vaccination sites. 4 of those vaccination sites are very large sites. The Cape Town Convention Center, in collaboration with the Western Cape Department of Health, Gallagher Convention Center, One Discovery Place, and then Park Square in KZN. Those vaccination sites run very efficiently and are able to vaccinate many people every day. We pride ourselves in a seamless, streamlined experience to get you through safe and efficiently. So you're more than welcome to access those sites either as a walk-in. If we've got space, we will accommodate you. Importantly, we only accommodate you if we've got space on that particular day. If you'd prefer, you can then make an online booking. And then you guaranteed your slot. We book those slots in 2-hour intervals. You'll know exactly when to arrive. We'll guarantee we'll get you in and out quickly and efficiently. It's almost like going to a concert if you think of it. There's a booking queue and there's a walk-in queue. You know, if you book beforehand, you're going to get a very consistent, streamlined experience. If you walk in, well, it may take a little bit longer. If there's space, we'll get you in. If there's not space, we might ask you to come back another day. But certainly make use of our online booking platform. It's very easy to use. It's also available to everyone, not just Discovery members. So even if you're not a Discovery member, you can navigate to the Discovery website, access our Discovery Vaccination Navigator, make a booking. We'd be delighted to host you.
So that's been it in this very wide-ranging discussion with Dr. Ronald Whelan, who is the Chief Commercial Officer over at Discovery Health, giving us some insight into what their data has been telling them or telling us about the first, the second, and the third wave, the different rates of infection, reinfection, hospitalizations, the mortality rates, and then also getting into data around how other types of vaccines have helped to eradicate or at least nullify other types of pandemics such as the smallpox, measles, mumps, and polio, getting into the different vaccines that we have in South Africa and the trends that they are seeing, you know, around the world. And one of the nice comments that came out from Dr. Whelan is that we seem to be in a vaccination race of some sort with different countries, you know, all vying for, you know, the title in some way, but it's good. A number that sticks out, 4.6 billion, that's the number of jabs that's been administered around the world. Really big number, and hopefully that number can go on even more. Also, just ending off saying that there are many vaccination sites around the country, but you can go to their online portal if you want to just go and register yourself on that end. So thank you so much to Dr. Whelan for your time, and thank you for tuning in to this Everything You Need to Know About COVID-19 and Vaccines podcast, brought to you by Discovery Health, where we unpack the facts surrounding COVID-19 and vaccines in South Africa. Tune into our next episodes. You can find our episodes available on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, wherever you choose to stream your podcasts. These episodes are also published on the Business Day and Business Live website. Please subscribe for free future episodes and ensure that you don't miss out. I've been your host, Mudiwa Gavaza. Stay safe, stay healthy, and join us in our next one on this Everything You Need to Know About COVID-19 and Vaccines podcast, sponsored by Discovery Health.